From KCUR, I'm Steve Kraske, and this is Up to Date. Throughout his presidency, Abraham Lincoln always had close confidants. No, not his wife or sons, but his secretaries. 2 weeks ago, we sat down with an historian to get a better look at the two men who influenced and documented Lincoln's actions and then reshaped his image after his assassination. And later, we talk with an award-winning pianist and singer about her unique approach to cover songs in jazz. All that plus local listen on Up to Date after this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. The image we have of Abraham Lincoln today as a great emancipator, father figure, and military genius might not be what it is if not for two men, John Hay and John Nicolay. The boys, as the president affectionately called them, were Lincoln's right-hand men during the course of his presidency and were closer to him than anybody else, save for members of Lincoln's family. They were also the men who dutifully reshaped Lincoln's image as it began to dip in the years following his assassination, and they helped mold it into the image of the great man we have today. Joshua Zeitz is the author of a new book on Hay and Nicolay titled Lincoln's Boys, John Hay, John Nicolay, and the War for Lincoln's Image. He has taught history at Cambridge and Princeton and once ran for Congress, and I'm guessing that the reason we have this very good new book is because he didn't win.
That's correct.
Josh, so good to have you. Welcome to Kansas City.
Thanks so very much. I appreciate it.
Well, to what extent were these two men, you know, who were so young they were barely men when they worked in the White House, to what extent were they accidents of history?
Very much so. I mean, they happened to be at the right place in the right time, and that was Springfield, Illinois in 1860. Nicolay was a young newspaper editor who became an aide to the state Republican Party, and he had known Hay since they were boys. Hay was a recent graduate of Brown University, wanted to be a poet. He had no interest in politics. His parents told him, you can't be a poet. You have to go become a lawyer. And he happened to be clerking in a law office that was owned by his uncle that was right next door to Lincoln's law office. So it was very much, you know, an accidental way in which particularly Hay, but really both of them came to know Lincoln.
So no question, right place, right time.
Absolutely, which can happen. And it was Illinois in 1860. Illinois was the, you know, the swing state that Illinois, Indiana, and Ohio, the Republicans needed to hold what they had won in 1856 and win two of those three states. So Illinois was at that time right in the center of the nation, you know, national political storm. And Springfield was right in the center of the state. So it was at the cross section between the southern leaning and northern leaning parts of the state. So it was literally quite in the eye of the storm.
Why did Lincoln manage to connect with these two men as effectively as he did, Josh?
You know, it's hard to say. Lincoln had for all of his effervescence and his tremendous political skills.
He was inscrutable, right?
He was inscrutable, a very, very private man, had a pretty distant relationship with his oldest son, Robert Todd Lincoln, very warm relationship with his two younger sons. But I think he saw in Nicolay and Hay the son, you know, two surrogate sons of sorts, particularly for Nicolay. You know, Nicolay was an a self-made man. He had come to the U.S. With his parents at age six, immigrated from Bavaria. He was an orphan by the time he was a young teenager, probably could count on both hands the number of months he had attended formal schooling. So I think Nicolay, you know, reflected in Lincoln's eyes something he could recognize in himself. And Hay was just a magnetic figure. Everybody who knew him loved him.
And he would go on to have an astounding career. You call him one of the great men of his age. He would become Secretary of State, not for just one president, but two, much less a top aide to a third president.
That's right. Hay had a habit of just landing in the right place and in the right circumstances. He ended up with Lincoln, and then he went on to have three really good diplomatic appointments, all when he was still in his 20s, in Madrid, Vienna, and Paris. He ended up becoming a lead editor of the New York Tribune, which was in his 30s, which was the leading, you know, newspaper of its day.
Yes.
Then he married a very, very wealthy woman and became very, very wealthy himself by extension. And became Assistant Secretary of State, Minister to Great Britain, Secretary of State. He had, you know, he had a great amount of luck.
The two of them got involved in politics. How, Josh?
Well, you know, Hay stumbled into it. He effectively was living in Springfield, wanted to be a poet, didn't want to be a lawyer, and was looking for anything that would enable him to stop reading the law. And so when Nicolay, who was working for Lincoln at that point in the immediate aftermath of the presidential election when Lincoln was president-elect, the work was overwhelming, and Nicolay needed help, and he asked Hay if he was interested in helping, and Hay was happy to do anything that didn't involve studying the law. And then, you know, Lincoln took him to Washington. Nicolay got to it in another way. He actually, after being orphaned, he worked as a printer's devil at a county newspaper.
And he was worried he was destined for a boring life.
That's right. That's absolutely right. And a printer's devil was a combination errand boy, typesetter, odd jobs man. You know, within 3 years, he actually was the editor and publisher of the paper, which gives you an idea of how incredibly bright he was. And this was in the 1850s when the debate over slavery, particularly after the Kansas-Nebraska Act was passed, it became the premier issue of the day, and Nicolay became a very fiery anti-slavery editor. He was strongly anti-slavery, as were many German immigrants to the U.S. He was a Whig. He was an early Lincoln follower and admirer. And in 1856 or thereabouts, when the Republicans won control, the new Republican Party won control of the state government, he went to Springfield and he held a job essentially as chief of staff to the Secretary of State of Illinois. But effectively what he was the what today we would recognize as the executive director of the state Republican Party. And so he quickly became known to everybody who mattered in Springfield.
You know, to what extent did the two of these men, you know, as they got into the White House and began working for the president, did they realize at the time that they were involved in something extraordinary here?
You know, Nicolay at one point early on in the war, early on in their White House tenure when they were living and working in the White House, he wrote to his fiancée, Thurina, and said, "We're living in stirring times, although I hardly recognize it as I live them," or something like that, as a paraphrase. And he acknowledged several times in his letters to Thurina that, you know, he sometimes missed or didn't appreciate the things that he was living. I think they had a consciousness of it, but as with anyone, it's difficult to understand, you know, what
they were busy guys.
Yeah. Look, when they went to Gettysburg with Lincoln in 1863 for the dedication of the cemetery, for them, it was a political trip. Lincoln was looking at trying to get renominated in 1864. He was unpopular in many parts of his own party. No president since Andrew Jackson had actually succeeded in getting renominated and reelected. So their job at the cemetery dedication, particularly the night before when you had this convergence of northern state governors, congressmen, newspapermen, their job was to manage his politics there. And to do that, they had to go out drinking all evening with the various dignitaries. So the next day, they were at the cemetery for the dedication. They heard the Gettysburg Address. They had certainly helped him work on it, but they were hungover.
Just some other speech, one more speech from the president.
It was one more speech from the president, and Hay's diary and Nicolay's letters don't suggest that they had much of an understanding of what they had seen. I think they thought that it was an important and successful political trip, but I don't think, you know, it was until many years later that they appreciated what they were living.
And just so we're being crystal clear here, one or both of these men is with Abraham Lincoln at virtually every single pivotal moment. We're talking about the Gettysburg Address, John Hay with the president when he lays dying, and it is just one thing after another here, right?
Yeah. I mean, I would say about 50% of the time they were probably both at the White House or with Lincoln. He didn't travel outside of Washington very often. He actually only made two or three trips other than to visit the field over the course of his presidency. So at any given time, I'd say about 50% of the time they were both there, and that the other 50% of the time one was there and one wasn't. And he would dispatch them on political or military missions. And sometimes they simply left Washington to get out of town and take a few weeks vacation.
And again, to be crystal clear, these two lived right down the hall from the first family. They lived in the White House.
That's right. There was no West Wing at the time. There was no separation. And it wasn't until Teddy Roosevelt, actually, that the West Wing was constructed and the president's offices moved into another wing of the White House. So In those days, and well into about 1900, 1901, the president's offices and office suite and staff suites were on the second floor, the living quarters, the White House. And so, one half of the second floor would be taken up by the president's family quarters. And the other half were, the president's office, the cabinet office, and the private secretary's offices and bedrooms. So they lived on the second floor with the Lincolns.
So the two Johns, Hay and Nicolay, they are the David Fluff. They are the David Axelrod. They are the Karl Rove of their era, right? They're sort of everything to Abraham Lincoln.
That's exactly right. I mean, they were, they were chief of staff. They were body man. They were press secretary. They were political director. They were clerks. I mean, they did it all. This was a day and age when you didn't have a very large White House staff. They had other people working under them, but they were understood to be the people who controlled access to him.
There's a wonderful story in this book, and I got a note in here somewhere I can't find right now. But you tell a story, I think, of Hay trying to tell a joke in the White House. Mm-hmm. And it's a story that really begins to illuminate just how heavy the burden that Lincoln was carrying during those years as the war raged on year after year. Tell us that story.
So it was a Sunday afternoon. It's not clear what year. And Nicolay and the other White House staffers were at work because it was a Sunday, but that's what you do if you work at the White House. Hay came in and started to tell a joke, and it was funny throughout. But he broke into hysterical laughter halfway through the joke.
Couldn't
get to the end. So Nicolay, Hay had been telling it to a guy named William Stoddard, who was another one of the White House staffers, and Nicolay heard all the laughter from his office. So he came in and said, tell the joke from the beginning because I didn't hear it. So he tries again, and he can't get through the joke, and now the three of them are rolling around in laughter, at which point they're in such hysterics they didn't realize that the president had slipped into Nicolay's office, the president had slipped into the office, and he sat down and slunk down into a chair and said, now, John, just tell that story one more time from the beginning. And this time Hay was able to finish it, and, the president was in uproarious laughter, and then, moments later, the Secretary of War walked in holding telegraph dispatches. It was very clear he was probably communicating some really bad news from the front, and the president's face immediately turned pretty dark.
And he stands up and leaves. They could see the burden of war resting on his shoulders clearly.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. So no question these three are very, very close. You also describe a moment, I think, when son Willie has died, that the first person Lincoln turned to, I believe, was Nicolay.
That's right. Willie was
absolutely devastating to the president here. You can't underestimate just what a blow this was to him in 1862,
It was early 1862. Mm-hmm. Both boys had gotten ill. There was a lot of disease that flew around Washington.
Yeah.
Willie passed away a day or two after they held their big state reception. And, when Lincoln learned of it, or I think he walked from Willie's bedroom into Nicolay's office and sat down and, told him, my boy is gone. And he was, in tears and crying and asked Nicolay to make sure that the funeral arrangements were started. I mean, it was an incredibly, on top of everything else the Lincolns had to deal with during the war, this bore heavily on them.
So no question, they're this close. They're just tight.
Yeah, that's right.
Working together every day. And one thing I wondered was, to the extent to which John Hay and John Nicolay were friends, because it would have been so easy for them to have become rivals for the president's favor during that time.
They had first met in 1851 when they were attending a small country school in Pittsfield, Illinois, and they had been they'd been fast friends from that moment. They went their own separate ways. Nicolay was editing his newspaper. Hay went to Brown. But by the late 1860s, they were both back in Springfield, where they kind of rekindled their friendship. And they were inseparable. They were like the dynamic duo. And when they moved to Washington, they shared a bedroom, at the White House. They worked side by side. When one of them was away, the two of them would exchange, upwards of two or three letters a day. Hay was Nicolay's best man at his wedding. I mean, they were just the closest of friends. Now, as they, as their lives grew a little more divergent in later years, Hay became extremely wealthy, mostly through his marriage, but also through his management of his wife's money. He also had a more successful political career. I don't think Nicolay wanted one. I think he was more interested in pursuing his literary pursuits. you know, they remained very close friends, and obviously they collaborated on their Lincoln biography for a quarter century. But, you know, Hay also became very close friends with Henry Adams and a number of other leading literary lights. But they remained, to the, you know, till Nicolay's death in 1901, probably each other's oldest friend.
We're visiting with Josh Zeitz about his new book, Lincoln's Boys, John Hay, John Nicolay, and the War for Lincoln's Image. I just wonder what you would give, Joshua, to have a chance to go back in that White House for a couple of hours and just be in their presence and get a feel for what how that place worked and how the two of them worked together.
Sure. I mean, anybody who writes a, you know, a work of history who spends 2 or 3 years looking through other people's letters and diaries,
you want
to know them. You want to get inside their head. You think you know who they were, but you don't know. You know, Hay is an interesting, you know, case in point. I mean, he was a really prodigious letter writer and diarist over the years, and he was pretty self-reflective. So I think that I get an understanding of his sort of larger character from this, but you never know because he was also a fairly calculating guy, and I don't know if he understood the people. I think later in life he understood we'd be combing through his diaries at some point. So it's hard to tell. You know, for instance, he refers to Theodore Roosevelt as the president in his later diaries, whereas, you know, in letters to Roosevelt, he called him Teddy. So I think that that was for us. I think that that was intended to, you know, that was for posterity.
And Nicolay had a little more of an edge to him, didn't he?
That's right. They were like night and day from a disposition, you know, standpoint. I mean, Nicolay was one of their colleagues said that he had a decidedly German way of telling people what he thought of them. He was
blunt.
He was extremely blunt. He was a sort of the, what somebody called the bulldog in the anteroom. I mean, he was extremely direct, extremely blunt, and he had to be in order to protect the president from, you know, the things presidents need to be protected.
So he was the heavy for Abraham Lincoln.
He was absolutely the heavy, whereas Hay was a sort of bon vivant. You know, somebody described him as the young man in the turtleback hat who will, when you ask him what's going on at Shebang, as he calls the White House, he'll tell you that the tycoon, he'll tell you that the tycoon is in fine form, which is what they both called Lincoln privately. But, you know, he was a kind of a ladies' man and a dandy and a very, very witty conversationalist and writer. So they were kind of yin and yang. Now, in terms of their relationship with each other, it worked, and they shared the same sense of humor and the same jokes and the same inside references. But they were absolutely different kinds of characters.
So 1865 comes. The president is assassinated by John Wilkes Booth. I'm wondering, how did that moment impact these two men?
You know, what's interesting is that Nicolay, who was normally more reserved and closed off, we know more about how it affected him because he wrote quite a few letters to his fiancée in the days after. He had been out of town when it happened. He was coming back into Washington from Cuba. He had taken a quick vacation. He was coming back in the day after Lincoln had died, and he knew almost instantly because they saw the flags at whatever port they were coming into. They saw the flags at half mast, so he understood what had happened. You know, he wrote a number of letters to his fiancée, and it's clear he was crushed. I mean, he was absolutely, you know, beside himself with grief. He and Hay had been planning to leave the White House in any event for the second term. Lincoln had appointed them to diplomatic positions in Paris. A lot of White House staffers leave after one term. That's still the case. It's an exhausting job. So they were getting ready. I mean, Nicolay was getting ready to get married, and then they were all getting ready to move to Paris, he, his wife, and John Hay together.
And at that point, a lot of folks thought the two of them had gotten too big for their britches, right?
That's right, which Hay said, I believe he said, a fault, which is probably either nature's or our tailor's, I think is what his line was. But no, I mean, for him, it was devastating when they didn't accompany the train back to Springfield. They went straight to Springfield for the burial. One of their old friends wrote in her diary about, you know, that she had seen them briefly the night of the funeral at a small gathering of old friends, and that Nicolay left almost immediately. That he looked, she said, his face was, you know, was too sad. He couldn't. His heart was too sad. You know, she wore it on his face. Hey, we're not sure, but I think it devastated both of them in many ways.
Because it really, you got to say this. I mean, these two men were really at the center of the political universe in those days, that generals and senators and everybody came to them because they were so well known in Washington. They really were at the nexus of power in Lincoln's White House.
No, that's right. I mean, they were prepared to cede that and go to Europe. And I think that they they were exhausted. I think for them, the loss was deeply personal. You know, and they certainly thought that Andrew Johnson was not equal to, even remotely equal to, Abraham Lincoln's legacy. He proved not to be. I don't think that they thought much of him. You know, his first days in Washington as vice president had not gone off very well either. So I'm sure that they thought that he was unequal to it. But for them, you know, the loss was personally very difficult to take. At one point, John Hay comes back to the White House shortly before he's to meet up with Tharina and George Nicolay. Nicolay went by George among his friends. So he's gone to the White House to pick up some of his stuff that he's left there, and then go meet them in New York. And he writes to Robert Todd Lincoln that, you know, the whole house – this would have been in May or June, I guess. He said the whole house was crawling with new secretaries, new clerks, you know, new supplicants. It didn't – you know, and he said – you know, he basically told Robert that he hoped never to go back in there again. Of course, you know, a year later he came back to Washington and he went to the White House. So.
Robert Todd Lincoln being the president's
son,
who was very close to John Hay.
That's right. He was close with both of them, but closer to Hay. You know, Nicolay was about 6 years older than them, and I think that well, Robert was probably a few years younger than Hay as well, but – Hay and Robert had a lifelong friendship, very close.
Joshua Zeitz is our guest again. He's the author of a new book, Lincoln's Boys, John Hay, John Nicolay, and the War for Lincoln's Image. And this is the part of the story that I sort of was new to me. I knew about their closeness with the president going into this book, but what I didn't realize was the extent to which they really managed the image of Abraham Lincoln from the time of his death going forward. Let's talk about that just for a little bit, Josh. How did all that begin? Because it's hard to imagine today, but in the years after Lincoln's death, he dies on a Good Friday, so there's this immediate outpouring of grief and this Christ-like symbol, in a sense, leader has died, given the fact it happened on Good Friday. But then his image begins to wane as succeeding years pile up on each other. What happened there?
Well, you know, he was always more popular with the northern electorate than he was with the nation's, you know, the elite men who then controlled the newspapers and the history books. I would also note that while he was popular, he was also deeply controversial in his time. You know, he was a war president presiding over a torn country. He had a strong Democratic opposition in the North that always viewed him as something of a tyrant. Mm-hmm. So he was, you know, but there's no doubt that he had a huge amount of popularity, particularly among Union soldiers and their families. He never enjoyed that kind of level of esteem among the sort of elite figures, both in and outside of his own party. And by the 1870s, it became, you know, it was safe, with memories having faded, for many of the kind of official guardians of the nation's memory and history to start talking about him as a very decent guy who was ultimately not very well prepared for the presidency.
In over his head.
To it, way in over his head, and thank God went the story, you know, that kind of line that he had appointed people like Chase and Seward to cabinet appointments so that they could guide the ship of state.
And be the adults in the room.
And be the adults in the room. That's right. So, you know, they took particular umbrage at a memorial address that Charles Francis Adams gave for William Seward in 1872. You know, Adams was the son and grandson of presidents. He had served as minister to Great Britain under Lincoln, but he never thought much of Lincoln. And he essentially said in this very widely reprinted eulogy that you know, it was only by the, you know, good grace of having appointed William Seward as his first minister, which was what I think he would have called it, that Lincoln was able to make sure that his administration were able to cope with the strains of a war, you know, as civil war. So Nicolay and Hay and Robert Todd Lincoln were deeply distressed by this. There was another piece that distressed them as well. A couple of the president's old friends, particularly William Herndon, his former law partner, and Ward Hill Lamon, who had been a kind of friend from the circuit days, they collaborated on a number of articles, lectures, and then ultimately each produced a book. Their goal was to try to demonstrate that Lincoln had not, you know, as Herndon said, he was not God. Lincoln was not God. He was man. He was a good man, but he was not God. They wanted to remind people that he was a human being. I mean, Herndon spent years combing the countryside in Illinois, Indiana, and Kentucky, interviewing people who had known Lincoln as a young boy and a young man. But in the service of trying to humanize Lincoln, they really knocked him down quite a few pegs. They inaccurately said that he, you know, he had been born the son of another man, not his father. Essentially, that he was a bastard son. They said that
he and Herndon again, a great friend of Lincoln's,
had been, but they hadn't been very close after Lincoln left for Washington. And Herndon and Mary Todd Lincoln couldn't stand each other, never could. So Herndon wrote of Lincoln's, you know, what we think might have been Lincoln's love affair early in life with a woman named Ann Rutledge, who he fell in love with, And he went away for his first term in the legislature and came back, and Anna died. And according to Herndon, he never loved another woman in his life. And again, and this is why his marriage to Mary Todd had been so unhappy.
Well, no wonder Mary Todd Lincoln didn't like him.
Yeah, well, they wrote. You know, I think Herndon suggested that Lincoln had syphilis. I mean, none of this was pleasing to the family. So
Hay and Nicolay see this going on and begin to realize that Lincoln's image has taken a hit here.
That's right.
He's beginning to wane a little bit here.
That's right, both at the popular level and at the elite level. And so they had been talking with Robert Todd Lincoln for quite a few years about the notion of doing an official biography of him, and they finally convinced him sometime around 1874 to give them exclusive access to his father's papers, which had been in a bank vault up until then. And they did enjoy exclusive access to all of Lincoln's papers. They actually had custody of them. Nicolay had – well, they divided them up and they'd send them back and forth. After they finished writing, you know, in the 1890s, Nicolay had possession of the papers in his house. And then after he died, Hay had possession of the papers. And then when Hay died, the Hay family turned them over to the Lincoln family. But they – these papers were closed off to the public until 1947.
I was really surprised to read that. Why so many years?
Well, Robert Todd Lincoln died, I guess it would have been 1926, and he closed the papers off for 21 years after his death. I don't know where he got the number 21, but there were two considerations. One was that he wanted that, you know, Nicolay and Hay collaborated between 1874, 75, and 1890. On a definitive 10-volume biography of Lincoln that relied heavily on these papers. And then it was serialized between 1886 and 1890 in the Century magazine, which was the most widely read.
I was going to say, this is a huge hit across the country.
That's right. And for basically every month for about 5 years, people were reading a new installment of their work. And about a third of the overall work was serialized. So that's how it sort of seeped gradually into public consciousness, and people looked forward to the next installment. And then the papers were closed off. I mean, Robert, on one hand, one of the considerations was that he wanted them to have the last word for a very, very long time. So it would be impossible for other writers, other scholars. There wasn't much of a historical profession at the time, but it would be impossible for other people to wade into this territory.
So they wanted to put the image in concrete
and keep it there. That's
keep
right.
It there. Yeah.
And the second piece is that there was a concern that there were still many men and women alive, or the sons and daughters of people who were addressed in these papers, and they didn't want to, you know, he didn't want to cause them any embarrassment. So, and today we tend to close off collections for a period of time after someone's death as well.
And so I guess the question then becomes, you know, was Lincoln the great man that we view him today, or did John Hay and John Nicolay, you know, turn him from a fairly ordinary man into something of a deity as a result of their PR campaign? I guess that's what it was back in those days, as a result of their work.
I think most historians would tell you that they were certainly biased court historians, so to speak, but that the fundamental argument that they made has held up pretty well. I mean, there's the wonderful book that many of us have read, Team Arrivals, in which Doris Kearns Goodwin, you know, follows a plot line that sort of or an argument really that suggests that Lincoln took, you know, these strong-willed leaders of the Republican Party and each of whom thought he was better suited to the job. And he formed them into this well-oiled functioning cabinet that served him and him. You know, that argument really was their argument, and it's held up pretty well.
Hay and Nicolay.
Yeah. I mean, they were the ones who argued first there are letters between them in which they state this is the argument here, right, that the cabinet members themselves, that he was, you know, that they ultimately, you know, he bent them to his will. But they, you know, they wrote him as a political genius, somebody who really understood mass politics in an era of changing communication.
But again, you're saying that historians over the years have pretty much said Hay and Nicolay pretty much got it right.
That's right. Even if they don't credit Hay and Nicolay, they will acknowledge that he was a very masterful politician. That in many cases he outgeneraled his generals, or he certainly learned from his mistakes. The idea that he kind of was the master of his cabinet after a while, I think, is held up, and that he could see the long game where a lot of other people around him would panic at the slightest setback. So, and I think that on the question of slavery, they much of what they wrote showing his evolution on the question over the course of the war has held up pretty well.
So no question, maybe the country would have come to this acknowledgement of Lincoln, this regard for him as being the great man that he was, anyway, but you're saying no question Hay and Nicolay sort of nudged that process along and made sure we got there.
They made sure we got there, and then they held the field, you know, for over half a century. You know, there were enormous volumes of material produced on Lincoln over the first half of the 20th century. Most of it was either a reinterpretation of documents that were in the public domain courtesy of Nicolay and Hay, or alternatively, you know, most of the scholarship focused on his early years because that was where they didn't, you know, spend a particular amount of time, a great amount of time, and you didn't need his presidential papers to write that. But, you know, in terms of analyzing his presidency, they really got to hold the field for well over half a century.
That's just an amazing thing. So the movie came out a few years ago, the movie off the book, the Doris Kearns Goodwin book. What did you make of that, Steven Spielberg's film Lincoln? What did you make of it?
I liked it. I reviewed it from a historian's perspective for The Atlantic. I thought, there were pieces of it I had quibbles with, but I thought by and large the interpretation of Lincoln was really strong, and certainly the acting job on it was you know, phenomenal. But I think that people missed the message in some ways, and I think the commercials actually sold an argument that ran counter to the actual argument in the film. You know, that film portrayed Lincoln as a brass-knuckled politician, you know, who was willing to expend tremendous capital and get deeply involved in the process himself and spend down that capital to achieve something like the 13th Amendment. I think most historians today would tell you that, while he wasn't quite as involved directly as that movie would have you believe, this was somebody who understood the art of politics, didn't think that it was a crass undertaking, believed that it could be used to and should be used to achieve great ends. The commercials sold Lincoln as a great uniter, right? In an era of increased polarization. I think the point was that he didn't think partisanship was a bad thing, and he was willing to engage it in order to get something done.
Josh, you wrote this in The Atlantic about this film. You said the film does not make Lincoln out to be humble, and indeed he wasn't. John Hay said this: it's absurd to call him a modest man. No great man was ever modest. Again, this sort of goes against, you know, how most people envisioned Lincoln.
Sure. I mean, he had a certain common touch as a candidate, and he was obviously a much more relaxed and informal type of office holder than most of the previous incumbent presidents. But by no means was he sort of a humble guy who fell into the presidency. Herndon said that Lincoln's ambition was a little engine that knew no end or knew no rest. I mean, he had been angling for this his entire life. He believed that he was better suited to it than any of his political rivals. And he certainly, over the course of the war, came to believe that he had he became more religious over the course of the war, not in a formal way, but he came to believe that, you know, there was a hand of God guiding events, and that, you know, I don't want to say that he thought he was that hand, but he certainly came to believe that he could divine what exactly the right course was, and that he alone was you know, suited to actually act on it.
Josh Zeitz, his new book, Lincoln's Boys, John Hay, John Nicolay, and the War for Lincoln's Image. What an interesting book. What an interesting conversation. Thanks for taking some time with us, Josh.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.